Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS political newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, Representative Sheldon Neely, the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, will be joining us. Talk about some exciting news that's happening in the state capitol. But first, guys, let's talk about one of the big news items of this past week, and that is that Sandy Pensler has announced that he's going to put $5 million of his own money into the race to succeed U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow. What does that buy you, John?
Well, it certainly buys you a lot of television commercials, if that's what he wants to spend his money on. It certainly makes the race more one to watch than we probably thought of last week after the former Chief Justice stepped out of the race. The fact that we've got resources on the opposition side is going to make it much more of a competitive race. And it might even get more national attention, too.
What does this do for John James, Jacob? Because it seems like now that Pensler has kind of set his flag in the ground, that it's up to John James to raise some campaign funds to at least look like he's being competitive here. Now, he announced the campaign team with some pretty high-dollar people on there. John Rickalter has been successful in helping raise money in the past. But John James is going to have to do something now.
Oh, yeah, that's very important. I mean, I think certainly he's ahead on the messaging front. I mean, he's been out kind of telling his story, and he's shown that's resonated on some national levels, too. But that's got to follow up some dollars. I mean, certainly the money talks, especially in this statewide U.S. Senate race. And I think Sandy Pensler is showing that he's serious and that he needs to be taken serious. And if John James wants to elevate his story even more, which he feels will be important to winning the nomination, he's got to get into the conversation money-wise.
We should mention one thing, though, that John James does have going for him, that Sandy Pensler hasn't proven yet that he does. And that's he's a character that can kind of generate a lot of spark and a lot of enthusiasm. I think we saw that on Mackinac Island at the Republican thing. Pensler did run before for a congressional seat. He did not get out of the primary. That was in the early 90s. The question is, I mean, he's got the resources, obviously. He's got the wealth to mount a strong campaign. But does he have the kind of personality that's going to spark enough enthusiasm to really turn out the vote and to be something that that can be really take it to that next level and be competitive and possibly knock off an incumbent like Debbie Stabenow?
Well, you would think he would need a coalition of some sort. Like, what is the type of Republican who is going to support Sandy Pensler? And is he going to be a conservative light, or does he have some type of message that resonates, that connects with people, like you said, John? Jacob, you at some point, as a candidate, you got to have some kind of message, and $5 million, you can probably develop some kind of winning message. I guess we just got to see what that is.
With that money he's putting in, I think the urgency now is to start using it and start getting that message out. I mean, it's kind of like what we've seen with Sri Tanadar in the governor's race. I mean, he has all this money he's sat on, and now he's finally using it. I think the urgency should be there to start getting your message out, start defining who you are and who you're trying to go after. And so we'll be looking for that very soon.
Switching gears here, John, this prevailing wage repeal effort, this has been a rocky road, hasn't it? I mean, there is no smooth sailing behind this thing. Secretary of State says we got to widen the sample. We got to make sure you've got enough signatures. They got to be a little nervous, don't they?
I think they should be very nervous. I mean, look, this is something that should be the equivalent of a field goal from the 20-yard line. Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, you got a Republican-controlled legislature. You got enough money behind this thing, or you should have enough money behind this thing to pay all sorts of petition signature gatherers and circulators to get it through the process. I would think the people and the organizations that have supported this now a second time would be a little irate and a little upset. And I kind of wonder if this doesn't make it out of the Secretary of State's office, doesn't make it over across the street to the Capitol for the legislature, are these groups going to pony up again, or is this going to be kind of, we're going to be sitting on this for the next 5 or 10 years before somebody says, all right, let's try again?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, because if you can't, I mean, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's kind of the situation that we're in here, Jacob. And then if they do have the signatures, do they have the support in the Republican House to get it passed? Now, you would think that they wouldn't have pushed forward if they didn't think they had the votes. And I understand they believe they have at least 60 votes, which is enough to pass this thing. But you do have some Republicans in some competitive districts where this wouldn't be a good vote for them.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And you can tell from their language that this cannot go to the ballot. I mean, I think the unions believe they have it won if it goes to the ballot. So the question is then on the legislature. And, you know, we've heard of a number of Republicans who are being targeted. And There are some that are openly torn about what they want to do. I mean, there's a hard push for skilled trades and what skilled trades does for the economy, and the union's making a hard push for, like, you are attacking your own position here on trying to improve skilled trades and that part of the economy. So I think there are some Republicans that are really torn about this, and it might not be a slam dunk like some are proposing.
When they were at the Capitol on Wednesday, John, the construction and building trades union folks were at the Capitol lobbying day. There were 10 particular Republicans that they were targeting. Representative Hawk, Representative Pete Lucido, Representative Steve Marino, Clint Kesto, Kathy Crawford, Mike Weber, Beth Griffin, Kurt Vanderwall, Dare Rendon, Larry Inman, Tristan Cole. So we've got some Northern Michigan folks. We've got some Oakland County folks.
Got some Senate candidates in there.
We got some Senate candidates. We got a congressional candidate in here. We got a couple of first-term Republicans here with Vanderwall and Steve Marino, Beth Griffin. There's some political calculations that got to go on here.
Yeah, and one thing that needs to take into consideration is that the line that's going to be used against them if they vote for prevailing wage repeal is that they directly cut the wages for working union tradespeople. I mean, that's the attack line the unions are using, and so you will certainly see that if that's the thing. So that's something they have to weigh in their districts and in their political situations.
Now, we talked to some of these individuals, John, and we didn't really get a firm commitment one way or the other. I think that's probably on purpose.
Well, think about it. Despite what some people might want you to believe, the labor vote is not a monolithic block, right?
No.
And it depends on the composition of your district. I mean, you can have conservative labor members who would otherwise support a Republican, but for this one issue. But for this one issue, they're going to walk out the door if you don't vote the right way.
Exactly.
So you better be careful, and you better think about how your district is comprised and who's going to be voting and what it actually means to you before you just assume, all right, this is a good Republican thing to go marching along with, because it may not be for individual lawmakers.
One more thing that I want to bring up, guys. We're going to be coming very close to the end of the collection period for the part-time legislature proposal, Clean Michigan Government. Probably by the end of the month, we should know whether they're going to have the signatures or not to put this on the ballot. They say it's going to be close, Jacob, and when I hear things are going to be close, that tells me close but no cigar.
When they're saying it's close, that sounds like they don't even know if they're going to get the signatures. I mean, there's so many. They did the mailing petition out. You know, those are coming in. They're trying to kind of gather all the petitions that are out there and make sure they're correct. I mean, you know, there's also the work to maybe hopefully verify and scrub whatever signatures you can. I mean, it just seems like there's a lot of moving pieces with their campaign, especially with the mailing that they did. And, you know, they're going to just kind of gather everything together and throw it at the Secretary of State and see what happens.
At the very least, turn in signatures that they claim is more than the minimum number they need. And what is it, 315,000?
Minimum number is 315.
So, John, if they can turn in, let's say, 320,000 and say, we turned in the number of signatures we needed to put this on the ballot and let the establishment kill it, that's almost just as good as putting it on the ballot, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't know if it's almost as good. It certainly, I suppose you could call it a partial victory. But I got to believe that they're not even close to having the number of signatures because, I mean, think about this. Think about what's already happened this cycle. I mean, with the voters, not politicians' proposal, we knew how many days ahead of time that they had plenty of signatures. I think if they were close, I think if they thought they had it, we'd already know it, and they would already be boasting about it. I don't think they're going to get close. I don't think it's going to be a matter of 5,000 votes. I think it's going to be a matter of 5, 10, 15 the other direction. So.
And with the mailing, you mentioned if they made it to 320,000, that's a 5,000 signature cushion. I mean, anytime you don't have a healthy cushion, that's reason for concern. And I think there's even more reason for concern with their campaign, given that they did a lot of their petitions by mailing it to people and expecting them to follow the instructions and submit them back, as opposed to that in person, like, hey, you got to fill out this line here, sign it there, kind of walking them through it. So there's a lot of variables with them mailing the petitions out and having them come back filled out exactly right. And so I think you're going to have a lot of error, and they're going to not have a lot of room for error wherever they're at with their signatures.
John Yob keeps telling me, you're going to be surprised, Kyle. You're going to be surprised. We're going to surprise a lot of people. We'll see how surprised we are come the end of the month. All right, with that, let's move on to our interview.
I have a dream that one day
Joining us on the podcast for this Martin Luther King Day is the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus here in the state of Michigan, Sheldon Neely. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me here with you. You know, it's always great to get my message out and get the message out what we're working on. And it's always great to talk to a credible news outlet.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative. We were talking off air here about a painting, a portrait that you guys are working on. Tell our listeners about this.
Well, this February, we're going to desegregate the portraits in the Capitol building. We will have our first African-American portrait to be hung. William Ferguson was the first African-American elected state representative out of the city of Detroit in 1892, less than 30 years after the emancipation. And so it's time to have the Capitol to be desegregated with that portrait being hung. And we're planning on doing that on February 28th at our annual Black History Celebration.
Now, he was not a Democrat.
No, at that time, you know, most African-Americans were the party of Lincoln. Lincoln was the author of the Emancipation Proclamation that emancipated many, many Americans, African-American Americans. And so many African-Americans and blacks at that time were a member of that party, which was the Republican Party at that time.
So how did this whole thing come about? Give our listeners a little background.
I wish I could say it was our intellectual property. What we joined, and we believe in partnerships and working together. And so a few other individuals came to the Black Caucus, and they said, wouldn't it be great if we had this to happen here? And so we took a look at it. And many of us did not realize that out of all the portraits, we didn't have an African American. We know about the portraits of the ex-governors of the state of Michigan, but we did not realize in full that it was no portraits at all hanging in the Capitol with African Americans.
And where are we going to hang this thing?
Well, we're going to hang it right outside the Appropriations Room on the Senate side. In previous years, the Supreme Court, that was the Supreme Court of the state of Michigan's chambers. The idea behind this is that William Ferguson, he sued the state of Michigan, and it was actually adjudicated right there in the Supreme Court in that particular chamber. He was victorious in helping to set some things straight as it relates to segregation in the state of Michigan and other things. But he actually had a lawsuit, and he won it in the Supreme Court in the state of Michigan, and his portrait would hang right outside of that chamber.
Those things aren't free. How were you guys able to commission this?
Well, much like anything, you know, we do fundraisers. You know, okay. We're not we're very adept to trying to raise dollars and cents, and from the philanthropic donors and also from the lobby corps, people thought this was a great idea. From both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, and all of our great donors, you know, they stepped right up, and it's a very heavy cost to get an oil painting and framed and make sure that it's respective of the quality of work that's going to be placed in the Capitol of the state of Michigan. So it is costly, but we're able to raise dollars, and we're still raising dollars to make sure that it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful event.
Who's painting this?
The artist that's painting it is an artist that had been selected by the Capitol Committee, who's painted portraits in the past, okay, to make everything very uniform. The name of the artist slips me now, but he has painted portraits that's to be hung in the Capitol previously, that's currently hanging now. And so we wanted to make sure that we got someone that was qualified to be able to do a great portrait.
Well, let's move on to the Black Caucus priorities. You got four here. What do you want to lead off with?
Well, you know, what's very important is the healthcare disparities in communities of color. The infant mortality rate, many people don't know this, that infant mortality rate is three times higher in communities of color than not. So we really worry about giving people an opportunity to live, you know, and if you can't make it beyond an infant, you have no chance at all. And so, you know, healthcare disparities in communities of color, we know we're facing some environmental challenges in the communities like Detroit and Flint, and we want to make sure that the healthcare disparity gap is closed, and we figure a way out to make sure that we can offset what's been going on previously in the state of Michigan and other places. Maybe we can come up with a recipe for success for the rest of the country, but healthcare disparities is one of the priorities that we have.
Does that mean an increase in public health money, or what does that mean?
We're unsure. You know, that quite a bit of money has been placed to the effort of just health care, but the health care disparities is something that's been very elusive to figure out the answer to what's going on. You know, some of the, you know, the healthcare disparities for communities of color, I can just use my district in the city of Flint. We have probably one of the best neonatal care hospitals in the state of Michigan, and it's firmly based right in the middle of the city of Flint, and we still have the same type of numbers that everyone else has in Detroit and Pontiac and Saginaw and communities of color. And so we want to really try to figure out what's going on. But dollars and cents are going to have to play a part, and we need to make sure that we get a fair share of the allocation of dollars and cents it's going to take to be able to offset this tragedy that goes on in these communities when you lose a child or infant.
One of the good news has to be that, according to the governor's office, it looks like Flint is lead-free with its water. Problem solved, right?
Well, you know, by the science of it, they're saying that. But remember, the Flint community was a community that was traumatized with this whole issue of water for the last 3.5 years. And traumatization is more mental than anything else. And when you have a traumatization, you have to go through a recovery period from the trauma. Though the scientists are saying the water is safe and lead-free to an acceptable level, people are not believing it. People are not drinking the water. So perception is a reality. And so you have a community that was traumatized. And so we have to really refocus. I believe they have to refocus and put dollars and cents to making sure the mental stability and the recovery is taken care of, and making sure these things are not taken lightly.
What do you mean, like an advertising campaign? Like put out billboards saying, hey, the water's safe, take pride in your city, that kind of stuff?
Well, not at all, because, you know, that could be much of just an advertising campaign. We really have to put more social workers into public places so people can talk about what's going on. They need to talk to seniors and those that may be shut in. We have to talk to parents where your kids are going to be educated in a community where the water still flows. We have to be able to talk to business owners and also patrons of those businesses, restaurant owners, and the people that may be going to those restaurants, to be able to say that we want to be able to not fear the glass of water that sits on a table at my favorite diner. So we have to go through an aggressive campaign of putting social workers and trained professionals in places to have dialogues, and also maybe in some cases one-on-one services for people. I've been advocating as a state representative that represents the district of the city of Flint to do that, but, you know, we have not been successful in that. And my hope and my prayer is that at some point in time, as they keep saying that the water is safe to drink, that they address these other things, or they're going to find themselves with another type of a crisis and confidence.
What grade would you give the governor on his reaction to the Flint water crisis? Because it looks like things are moving on the right track. He allocated quite a bit of money toward Flint after the problem was found. Does he get a passing grade in your mind?
You know, he's in the second semester of the grading period, right? So we have to look at the results. And as he turns his homework in, we have to really look at the real results of this. When we talk about a crisis that happened in the city of Flint, and we're looking at crises such like this that could happen in Detroit and in older communities with older infrastructure, we have to look at what has been put in place to safeguard Michiganders, whether it be in Birmingham, whether it be in Detroit, whether it be in Grand Rapids. What has actually been put in place as a byproduct of this? There has only been one state statute put in place to help safeguard residents as it relates to water quality in the state of Michigan. And some would say that would be a failing grade. If we know that we have a problem, the problem has been investigated and looked at, in some cases criminalized, if we only have one state statute, and we are in Lansing, a body of legislators, and we also have the executive of the state of Michigan here, what does that really say to Michiganders if we only put one state statute in place to help safeguard Michiganders? And I think many people would say that, well, we're still waiting on the rest of the work, Governor. You have another year to try to cram to do all the extra credit work that you need to get a passing grade.
And you're talking about the legislative task force report that had some 30, 40 recommendations. And Stephanie Chang, one of your colleagues, has put out several bills, only one so far. Yep. What about the Promise Zones? Is that, do you get something for the Flint Promise Zones, or is that the one that we're talking about?
No, the Promise Zone talks about educating young people and giving them education, some of the things that, you know, we've seen be successful in Kalamazoo, but that surrounds education. We're talking about safeguarding water resources. The only one bill that has actually made a state statute is the bill that I authored, which talks about the warning mechanisms for Tier 2 violations with drinking water. It had previously been 30 days. A municipality or governmental agency had up to 30 days to warn people that they had a toxicity or some type of impediment for human consumption for water. They had 30 days to actually get that information to the people that would be consuming the water. The legislation that I wrote said that was far too long, that we need to give them 72 hours to make sure that people understood that they had a problem with their drinking water source. And that's the one that has been put in place. Okay. As a collective body in a water group, I'm a part of, as well as Stephanie Chang, LaTanya Garrett, and other representatives, we put a collection of many bills, Senator Ananak, Representative Phil Phelps. We had probably maybe more than 20 bills, and they have been reintroduced in this session, and they still sit idle right now in a committee, not being heard. And these have been recommended to take hold by those bipartisan committees. You know, we wonder, why are these still being placed in at bay and not being actually executed upon?
We mentioned education. How are we doing on education? We were at the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference. They say that numerically we haven't spent more on education than we have right now. Is that helping the problem?
Well, right now, we're experimenting with different things. We know that charter schools are a permanent part of our educational landscape in a public setting. Public systems are trying to get dollars. It could be more going into education, but it's dispersed over many different fronts. And so we don't get that intense educational revenue that we may need in some public settings in our public school base. And so it's causing some problems in communities that are struggling. And also you had legislation put in place, the third grade reading mandates, saying that if a kid is not reading at a third grade level, they are automatically to be retained, absent the input of their teacher, school principal, superintendent, school board. It is a state statute. So you had, 148 legislators, determining and debating about that and taking that away from the educator themselves. And it could prove to be emasculating for some children, derailing what could possibly be a good, successful educational career. But in some aspects, the Promise Zone that we have in Kalamazoo, the one that Governor has just signed into law for the city of Flint, is some motivators for people to participate in the educational process fully. And one thing that we have now in the city of Flint, the state of Michigan has allowed a 3-year grant for a virtual library. Many communities that's challenged with revenue, they don't have the places where people can go to read and actually get the skills they need. And so the city of Flint will be opening this first virtual library next month in February. And I'm very proud that, that this thing is going forth. And I was able to be an integral part of this. And the state of Michigan also granted these dollars for this way to help educate people.
All right, Representative, we got 3 of the 4. We got healthcare disparities, the water, education. One more thing on your list here. What is it?
Well, criminal justice reform. The state of Michigan, and people probably don't know this, though, that lives in the state of Michigan, but Michigan has the longest prison sentences than any state in America. We spend billions of dollars on correctional facilities, but we do have a lot of nonviolent offenders that's been excessively sentenced in the state of Michigan that's spending a long time incarcerated in the state of Michigan that is at the expense of taxpaying dollars. One thing that makes community grow is our citizen base, and we need to rehabilitate these individuals, get them back into our citizenship to try to help make them productive citizens so they can contribute to the health and welfare of our state of Michigan. But if we keep incarcerating at these high levels and keeping people in prison for longer periods of time, we don't accomplish that goal. We continue to spend billions of dollars on incarcerated individuals. We have people that's spending, you know, a decade and a half or 2 decades in prison for marijuana violations, not a threat to society, but marijuana violations. But now we see dispensaries opening up on every corner in every community throughout the state of Michigan as we debate legislation in Lansing here to legalize maybe some medicinal use of marijuana. So, and at the same time, we have people still sitting in prison for violating, not to say that they were innocent of the crime that they were convicted of, but we don't necessarily have to have them spend 2 decades in a penitentiary for that. And so criminal justice reform is a priority. What we did as a caucus, we took a look at who was in prison, and we picked maybe four individuals, and we placed it in front of the governor. These were nonviolent offenders, people that was excessively sentenced by all standards of what we look at. It's just that they just got a big bad deal, and we asked them to commute some sentences. This governor that we have here has not commuted many sentences, if any, right, in the state of Michigan. I know that probably was a campaign promise, but he needs to really look at, you know, justice and how justice is being administered. And we know communities of color, we have a lot of people convicted of crimes, and we know the war on drugs was a war on inner cities as well. So you have many victims there. You have many people with crack addictions, but now we're talking about opiate addiction, and we look at opiate addiction of us providing them with treatment. Crack addiction, we provided them with jail sentences. And so we need this governor to really look at fairness and where is the justice in that. And so we place that before the governor as a priority. And hopefully this year he takes a real hard look at it and moves in a positive direction to help try to administer some justice to Michigan.
All right. Well, thanks for running through these priorities. Representative Sheldon Neely, chair of the Legislative Black Caucus.
Thank you. God bless.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Representative Neely for taking time with us, John and Jacob. And John, it sounds like we had a burial this morning. The proofreader's computer sounds like it is men its end.
Yes, it did.
And we've got taps playing right now.
It did.
How many soldiers are buried in the crypt there in MERS World Headquarters?
I think we were probably up to 10, maybe.
Wow.
Since I've owned the company, yeah. I have some, actually one of the first Apple laptops that we bought that came out. And
wow.
The things look like tanks. They're like 4 inches thick. you know what I'm talking about? They're a plastic that's got gray military-looking plastic with the color Apple on the top.
Sounds like we have our side venture is the Apple History Museum.
We actually could start an Apple museum. I've got a Bondi blue iMac in the basement. I've got a pink iMac in the basement. I've got these, you know, archaic laptops that were the first ones. So I mean, we really have Apple covered. If they ever need backups for their museum in Cupertino, California, they can come to MERS, and we'll be happy to sell them at a reasonable price.
So much history in this building founded in 1893.
Yes.
Well, you know what? If nothing else, John, maybe we can take Galloway's old office here and turn that into like the MacBook Museum.
Maybe.
Maybe charge admission.
Maybe.
Get another source of revenue.
Maybe.
Although you really wouldn't be able to look at the outsides. I understand these probably none of these probably work. So you probably wouldn't be able to look at how they run.
Some of them will start, but then they won't stay on, or the screens flicker, or they just got to the 10-year mark, and I decided rather than invest any money, I'm going to get a different one.
I like your strategy. Well, we'll ponder these different ideas on what to do with our dead MacBooks, but we're not going to throw them in the dumpster, so don't call DEQ on us. Something good will happen, I am sure.
Yeah.
Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
So let freedom ring.